Hey, Morbidology listeners. Before we get on with today's episode, could I please request that you don't judge Morbidology on the early episodes? I'd recommend maybe listening from the newer ones backwards, because I honestly didn't find my feet in podcasting for quite some time. The quality of the early episodes, as well as the hosting, is not a true representation of Morbidology today, and I'm currently in the process of redoing them all. If you do listen to the earlier episodes, please don't judge the show on them, and maybe give a newer one a listen before deciding if the show is for you. Thank you so much for all of your support, and now on with the show. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. If you're driving along Interstate 80 at the Utah-Nevada border, or as it's commonly called, Cowboy Corridor, your eyes will be drawn towards a massive neon cowboy, waving suggestively into the sun. This cowboy's name is Wendover Will, and he has been welcoming gamblers to West Wendover, Nevada for almost seven decades. West Wendover is a small city that has thrived under a lucrative gambling industry in Nevada. In addition, it's also known for its legal brothels and boy racers attempting to break the speed records at nearby Bonneville Flats, as well as the Air Force Base where Enola Gay took off, heading straight for Hiroshima. In fact, scenes from the movie Independence Day were filmed here. Amidst these tales, however, is a story so shocking that it still wends through the deserts of West Wendover today. A story about a tragic night where three local families lost their teenage children. West Wendover was the home of 16-year-old Michaela Costanzo. To her friends and family, she was known simply as Mickey, and they could always count on her to put a smile on their faces. Next, we will hear from Jackie Rodin, one of Mickey's best friends.
Mickey was extremely friendly. She was friendly to the point of being able to talk to someone and joke with them and almost say mean things to them in a way that you just loved her more. She would be very blunt with people. She was just hilarious. And I think that's why so many people loved her. She was very bubbly, very loud. When she was happy, she would be with as many friends as she could. If she was kind of having a down day, she would kind of stick around to one or two friends and stay close to them. But there was never a time when Mickey was not being supported or loved by friends. And I think the whole school had experiences with Mickey when they remember something kind that she did for them or something fun that they did together. I think everybody that I've talked to really loved her and felt a friendship with her, even if it wasn't really close. But she kind of portrayed this friend personality that everyone, you know, was attached to.
Mickey was a great student and star athlete at West Wendover High School. She played in the basketball team and was a track star. She also loved writing poetry and short stories. She was the editor of her school's newspaper, and as her journalism teacher said, quote, she could crack a whip and get the kids to do anything like nobody else could, end quote. Mickey dreamed of becoming an author. In her spare time, Mickey's mother, Celia Costanzo, had been teaching her how to cook. The mother-daughter duo had a very close relationship, and Mickey would always make sure to check in with Celia to let her know what she was doing throughout the school day. There was never a day that Celia wouldn't be up to date with Mickey's plans.
Michaela is not your typical teenager. That girl would check in with me all the time. So we have a routine. I'm changing. I'm going to be heading out. I'm heading out the back, you know, I'm heading home. I'm home.
Mickey was also exceptionally close with her older sisters, Christina and DJ.
I'd consider us twins. Everything we did, we had to be together. If we weren't at the same place, we always had to know where the other was at all times.
As the sun began to fade on the 3rd of March 2011, Celia was at work in one of the local casinos, expecting her routine phone call from Mickey to let her know that she was walking home from track practice. However, no phone call ever came. As this was so out of character for Mickey, Celia immediately became concerned. She attempted to call Mickey, but to no avail. Celia called her older daughter, Christina, who was in Las Vegas, and asked if she had seen or heard from Mickey, to which she replied no. Filled with dread, Celia left work early and drove right home. She was hoping that she would see Mickey on the way home or already at the apartment. However, when she arrived, her heart sank when she realized that Mickey wasn't there.
She did not call me to tell me track practice was over and she was getting ready. She didn't call me to tell me she was walking home. And so I started calling her phone. And it rang and rang and rang the first time. And then I called it right back because that was unusual. And it was like you hit the ignore button. This is so not her.
Celia called police and gathered a number of friends and family to assist in the search for Mickey. Veteran detective Donald Burnham was assigned to the case. He and his officers retraced Mickey's steps and started an investigation.
By the time I had already called the police, there was already over 80 people starting to look. The police asked me, did you check with this one? And all of her friends, did you go any place that she would go? I'm like, yes. And they're all panicked and they're all out looking and everything. So they immediately knew something was wrong.
They were able to access Mickey's phone records and they noticed that there were a lot of phone calls and texts to and from the same phone number. This flurry of back and forth came just around the time that Mickey was scheduled to leave school. They then abruptly stopped. The phone was traced back to 18-year-old Cody Patton, a senior football player at the same high school as Mickey. At one point in time, Patton's family and Mickey's family had lived in the same apartment complex, and Patton was a frequent guest at Mickey's home. According to one of Mickey's friends, the two had dated in middle school, but Mickey eventually grew to dislike Patton. According to Celia, it was just puppy love.
They grew up together. They were friends. Michaela was not allowed to date till she was 16, but I'm sure it was probably like puppy love, what I call puppy love.
On the day of Mickey's disappearance, she had told a friend that Patton had been texting her throughout the day about a school project and said that he would pick her up from school. Mickey was confused by the text messages because she and Patton weren't close any longer. Patton was brought in for questioning and told police that he had seen Mickey at school at around 5:30 p.m. on the day she disappeared. According to Patton, Mickey had been with her boyfriend.
The last time you seen her was?
About 5:30.
And that was where?
At high school.
She was with somebody?
Just some. I thought it was her boyfriend because it was a short
her mix. Boyfriend being Javier?
Yeah.
Do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, find her, please.
With no evidence of a crime, Patton was let go after questioning. At the time of Mickey's disappearance, Patton had a girlfriend named Toni Fratto. Fratto had come from a Mormon family that offered her unconditional love. At 13 years old, she was a beauty queen and she was devoutly religious. In school, she was described as a kind and gentle girl, as well as a good student and a good friend. She mostly kept to herself and had very few friends. Patton, on the other hand, had a hot temper and struggled in school and with his parents despite the fact that he came from a hard-working and close-knit family. The young couple were inseparable after beginning dating in the 9th grade.
She loved him. She thought she loved him.
He was very, very possessive, did not like her time taken up by anyone else but him.
Around a year earlier, Fratto's personality began to change. She was completely infatuated with Patton and her parents blamed him for this character change in their daughter. According to her mother, Cassie Fratto, she had allowed Patton to move into their home because they feared that their daughter would run away from home if they didn't allow it. The young couple often spoke about marriage and Patton had been baptized into the LDS church so that they could eventually wed. He had even purchased Fratto an engagement ring. Cassie and her husband, Claude Fratto, believed that Patton was desperately trying to get his life back in order. They thought that by allowing him to move in, they could become a constructive family for the troubled teenager.
I wanted to extend a hand to him to help him get through school.
We became his second family, and more importantly, we were really invested in his success.
He was like a son to me.
Meanwhile, the search party combed through the arid desert surrounding the city. On the third day of the search, local man Michael Moore had been searching alongside some railroad tracks in the desert approximately 5 miles from Mickey's home when he noticed some fresh tracks. He decided to follow them and came across some sagebrush sitting on top of a mound. It was evidently out of place, so he thought to take a closer inspection. Searching further, he noticed some blood and what looked like flesh peeking out of the gravel pit. Moore alerted Ron Supp, West Wendover's chief of police. Upon arrival, he covered up the site because it looked as though rain was fast approaching, and he immediately called the Elko County Sheriff. Detective Kevin McKinney raced down to the scene the following morning.
He removed the sagebrush and gently dug into the area and found what we thought was part of a human body. We backed out of the area and contacted Washoe Crime Unit to come in and exhume that area for evidence.
The following morning, it didn't take them long before they unearthed Mickey's body. She had been slashed and stabbed across the face, neck, and head, and her throat had been slit. She had also been bludgeoned with a camping shovel, and zip ties were wrapped tightly around her wrist.
It was very emotional. The age of the victim and the brutality, I guess disturbing would be the word. Several jagged slashes across her face, neck, head. The blood loss had saturated the ground underneath her. It was very aggressive. It was not a precision type of injury.
The officers next had the daunting job of delivering the crushing news to Mickey's family.
My heart sank to the pit of my stomach, and I screamed. I just dropped. I just kept screaming.
The one thing I will never, ever forget in my entire life is watching my daughter DJ scream, this scream I haven't heard from her even as a baby, and fall to the ground in shock and disbelief. She physically did what I felt like I wanted to do, but I couldn't do it because I'm the mom. I had to keep myself together. I had to be the strong one.
Now the investigation shifted from a missing teenager to a murdered teenager. In a bid to retrace Mickey's steps, investigators began the tedious task of looking through the school's CCTV. They picked up a grainy image of Mickey just outside the girls' locker rooms. But she wasn't alone. She was with Cody Patton.
We started doing a little digging. We went back to the school. We obtained some video surveillance. Just prior to her leaving from the back of the school, we saw Cody Patton leave the same doorway.
Cody Patton was probably the last person to have seen her due to the fact she had left through the southwest doors and he was in that area.
When police asked to speak to Patton again, his father, Kip Patton, drove him down to the station.
Did you sleep okay last night?
No.
Why not?
I slept horrible since Mickey was missing.
How come?
Told my friends. And I said, okay, you all right? She goes, yeah, I'm fine. I said, okay, well, no worries, have a good one. She said, all right, bye. And that was it.
Patton retold the same story that he had told police several days prior, that he had seen Mickey outside the front of the school, but that they had gone their separate ways.
He had seen her at the front of the school with her boyfriend, and everyone else had last seen her exiting out the back of the school.
The officer interrogating Patton pushed. He told him that he had CCTV footage that placed him and Mickey together and phone records which indicated that they had been chatting back and forth all day on the day she disappeared.
Okay, so what are you getting at?
What I'm getting at is you're not being totally truthful with us.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not. The video from the school indicates to us that you were waiting for her.
Okay. I wasn't.
because that was the time she disappeared. And that was the time she died. And you were involved.
I wasn't involved in her death.
I know you were now.
I did not kill the statue.
I don't think you planned on it. I don't think you intended to.
I didn't. I didn't do anything.
Patton then asked the officer if he could speak to his father alone. The officer agreed and let the father and son chat by themselves.
You gotta start fixing this now. As much as you can. What you did is heinous, Cody. I don't want to abandon you at all. Okay? You gotta do what's right for the game as well.
When the officer came back into the interrogation room, Kip urged his son to confess to what he had just confessed to him. Patton then broke down and confessed that he had killed Mickey. He claimed that he and Mickey had gotten into an altercation when Mickey asked him to leave Fratto.
She started yelling at me and I said it's because I'm not leaving Tony, huh? She started like pounding on my chest and stuff. She fell down and hit her head. She just laid there and was looking at the sky. And, like, her eyes started to turn black. And I didn't know what to do. I just sat there and she started to, like, shake and seize. I tried to, like, check her pulse and stuff and I couldn't get anything and she was flopping.
He claimed that after Mickey had hit her head and had a seizure, he sliced her neck with the sharp side of the shovel.
And then she stopped. I didn't know what to do. I was gonna call my dad. What I do? He would freak out. So they put her in the little grave thing I dug by the big bush. They covered her up and took the clothes over in the gravel pit area and burned them.
He said that he acted alone in the murder and never implicated anybody else. He even claimed that nobody else knew about what he had done. It was pretty evident from the beginning that this was no tragic accident, however. For one, Mickey had sustained a prolonged and vicious attack, and a number of the wounds appeared to have come from a knife and not a shovel. Furthermore, why did Patton bring along the shovel unless he had already planned how he was going to use it? Another peculiarity was the zip ties wrapped tightly around Mickey's wrists. If she had gone willingly out to the desert with Patton, then what purpose did the zip ties serve? In all likelihood, Mickey was abducted after leaving school. As the community tried to come to terms with the senseless murder, a candlelit vigil was held in the West Wendover High School gym. Around 600 mourners filled the bleachers and lined the basketball court. Principal Terry Carsrud opened the vigil by saying, quote, "The loss of Michaela has left a hole in the soul of our school, and it hurts so bad. I'm seeing the love Michaela has for you in the way you've been comforting each other," end quote. While the vigil tried to focus on positivity, whispers were being circulated around the gym about the arrest of her killer.
I was completely shocked. It's not the person that I knew, and my husband was there, and I said, "Cody didn't do this. He would never hurt her." And he says, "Babe, he did." And I said, "Then somebody made him do it."
Mickey's family especially couldn't quite reconcile the kind-hearted Patton that they knew from years ago as their daughter and sister's vicious killer. Furthermore, they didn't believe the story that Patton had told. At the time, Mickey had a steady boyfriend and had been steering clear of Patton and Fratto, knowing all too well that they were engaged. Mickey was a sweet and caring girl who despised confrontation and drama. Her family said that there was just no way that she would be trying to split the couple up. Meanwhile, Patton faced one count of felony open murder, which carries a potential death sentence. In jail, he hired John Olson as a defense lawyer. Patton's girlfriend, Fratto, wasn't initially considered a suspect in the brutal slaying, but shortly after Patton's arrest, she made a startling confession to his lawyer. She confessed that she had participated in Mickey's murder as well.
"Sir, are you willing to proceed?"
"I think so, yeah."
"Am I to believe that you in fact were present when the girl got killed?"
"Yes."
Fratto confessed that the three teenagers drove out to the desert, where Mickey and Patton got out of the car.
was a rage just for like a split second, and then heard like a loud thud on the car or whatever. So I had got out to see what happened.
What did you see when you got out?
Michaela was on the ground, and she wasn't really moving at that point.
According to Fratto, she was sitting in the car when she heard a loud thump or a thud. She said that she got out of the car to see what the commotion was about and saw Mickey lying on the floor.
She wasn't moving, and so we moved her to the grave, and then we were kind of standing there deciding what do we do. We didn't know what really we had just done. I remember like holding down her legs, and we had slit her throat.
According to Fratto, Patton then pushed Mickey away from him and that she fell and hit her head on the car. Patton and Fratto then kicked Mickey, beat her with a shovel, and then slit her throat. According to Fratto, she sat on Mickey's legs as they both slit her throat together. She confessed that following the murder, she gathered up some of Mickey's possessions, which included a t-shirt, some notebooks, keys, a best friend charm, and a black and white polka dot bag, and burned them along with the murder weapon at a gravel pit across town.
After that, she wasn't really breathing or anything, and so we kind of just stood there, we're crying because we didn't know what we had just done.
The confession was recorded, and since Fratto didn't have an attorney-client relationship with Patton's lawyer, he handed the confession over to the prosecutors. Fratto was subsequently arrested and faced felony counts of open murder and acting as a principal to open murder, and misdemeanor charges of willfully destroying evidence of the commission of a felony.
I, in my heart of hearts, knew Tony had something to do with it, because they were a couple. It was very hard for me to know she was at school, wearing his engagement ring, acting like nothing had happened, and she knew nothing about it, when I knew she knew.
I said, I am so glad that she is now sitting and facing what he is. Now it makes sense.
Both Patton and Fratto had preliminary trials during which evidence against them was put forward. Tony Fratto's 2011 preliminary trial focused mostly on testimony about her co-defendant Cody Patton. Mickey's mother, Celia, was the first to take the stand to identify a number of Mickey's belongings that were discovered at the burn site. Donald Burnham, a detective with the West Wendover Police Department, testified that during a search of Fratto's mobile home, he found a trenching tool hidden underneath the house. Patton's father, Kip, also testified that in addition to confessing to Patton's lawyer, Fratto also confessed to him. According to Kip, Fratto said, quote, Cody got out of the car to start digging while Tony and Michaela were still in the vehicle. Then they got out standing next to the vehicle with Cody facing Michaela. Tony hit her with a shovel in the back, end quote. Kip also had told the court that after beating Mickey, they dragged her to the hole and slit her throat. Kip acknowledged that both his son and Fratto were involved in the murder and said that Fratto had confessed because she didn't want Patton to pay for something that she had participated in. Judge Dan Papez described Mickey's injuries, reducing many in the courtroom to tears, including the parents of Cody Patton. Quote, she suffered during the attack. It took a long time for her to die. Horrible suffering, end quote. Ellen Clark, the chief medical examiner for Washoe County, pointed to the autopsy photographs of Mickey's body. She showed the bruises on her neck and stab and slash wounds to her face and neck, including the one that cut her jugular vein. Fratto's defense lawyer, John Springate, attempted to offer an explanation for his client's role. He said that Fratto was not a black widow, but rather a sheep. He said that psychological testing showed that Fratto had the mental and emotional maturity of a 15-year-old. He said that she was being controlled by a boyfriend who was jealous, possessive, and isolating. Around a month before the murder, CCTV at West Wendover High School caught Patton, who was 6'6" tall, pushing Fratto, who was 5'1" tall, against a wall, lifting her legs up off the ground as he choked her. After this incident, Fratto refused to press charges because she was afraid that Patton wouldn't get into the Marines. According to Springate, this wasn't the first or last time that Patton had abused Fratto. Patton's lawyer, John Olson, completely refuted these claims despite the fact that there was physical evidence in the form of a video recording. According to Olson, the claims that Fratto was abused was baloney.
Baloney. There's nothing in their relationship ever that would indicate that she was ever abused by Cody.
Fratto offered an apology to Mickey's family during the preliminary trial. Quote, I know what I did was wrong, and therefore I am taking responsibility for my actions. I'm sorry for what I did, and I'm sorry for what I did not do, and that is protect Michaela. End quote. The hearing ended with Justice of the Peace Al Kassin ordering Patton and Fratto to stand trial on charges of open murder, kidnapping, destroying evidence, and other counts. In early 2012, Cody Patton took a plea deal in which he had to plead guilty to first-degree murder to avoid the death penalty. However, just as quickly as he took the deal, he changed his mind and decided to take his chances in court. The following day, however, the district attorney offered Tony Fratto a deal. If she testified against Patton in court, she would be allowed to plead guilty to second-degree murder with the chance of parole after 18 years. Fratto agreed to throw Patton under the bus in a bid to save her own life and signed the plea papers. Fratto then changed her story as to what had happened on that fateful evening.
I'm a person to tell the truth, and deep down I wanted people to know the truth because I knew Cody wasn't going to come forward and tell the complete truth.
She said that Patton had been angry with Mickey and that he couldn't stand to see her or even hear her voice. She said that Patton had ominously texted her, quote, I have her, end quote. When Fratto had climbed into the car, Mickey was tied up in the back seat with an expression of fear frozen on her face. Fratto said that throughout the journey to the desert, Patton remained silent and sullen. Then when they stopped, he texted Fratto while sitting beside her.
And it said, we have to kill her. Just kind of looked at him and kind of looked, why?
Fratto now claimed that she was an unwilling participant in the murder, but was forced to hit Mickey with the shovel out of fear that Patton would turn on her next.
All I remember is him pulling her hair back, and I went up and hit her in the face. I remember looking up at Cody and him telling me, hit her with the shovel, hit her with the shovel. And so I hit her in the back of the shoulder with the shovel. And then I remember going up and holding her legs down so she stopped kicking. And then all of a sudden her legs went completely still and she wasn't moving. And that freaked me out. So I backed off and jumped up and walked off a little bit. She had looked up at Cody and asked, am I still here? Am I still alive?
In this version of events, it was Patton alone who slit Mickey's throat. She then told the district attorney that she had no idea what Patton's motivation was to kill Mickey. And just like that, Fratto had secured her deal and was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole after 18 years. But this new confession just led to a number of questions. For example, if Fratto was terrified of Patton, then why did she visit him in jail and send him love letters after his arrest? Why did she claim that she was involved in the first place? Now, before Fratto's arrest, she had handed over her diary to Patton's family. They handed it to their son's defense lawyer, who found some interesting pieces which gave a grim insight into Fratto's character. She wrote in her diary that she was terrified that Patton would cheat on her or would leave her for someone else. She was worried that she and Patton wouldn't last forever and that she had attempted to overdose after an argument with Patton. She also wrote in her diary about Mickey, quote, we might as well break up so that he can get back together with her. He would be a lot happier and can see her a lot. They are perfect for each other, end quote, read one entry. So with this diary, we may have a slight hint at a potential motivation. Fratto was clearly insecure. And could she have been threatened by Mickey?
Tony used to get so upset if Michaela was seen talking to Cody. And she would just yell and holler and say horrible things to Michaela. You know, don't talk to him and call her every name imaginable.
He couldn't be around girls, especially my sister, but he couldn't go do certain things, she couldn't go do certain things, and if one did it that the other didn't like, it was World War III.
I must have been doing laundry or something, and here Tony came walking, and he was like, gotta go. And I was like, you can't even talk to me? He was like, no, I gotta go. I can't be seen. She'll get mad.
After the sentencing, Fratto's mother, Cassie, contended that her daughter was a good person with a bright future, but that she had become the victim in an emotionally and physically abusive relationship with Patton. Quote, Tony's not a monster, end quote, she said, pointing out that her daughter had handed herself in to accept responsibility for her role in Mickey's death.
He would yell at her, he would be pushing her around, he would be
restraining her,
throwing her down. She was living in fear of what she thought the repercussions would be if she brought it out. So her participation, as people say, in what happened that night was strictly out of fear, controlling, manipulation, and orders by the one that she had already been suffering abuse from for 2 years, 3 years. She was afraid that she would be the one lying next to Michaela if she did not follow his orders that evening.
Just weeks before Cody Patton's trial was scheduled to begin, he pleaded guilty to first-degree murder to avoid a potential death sentence if he went to trial. Quote, it was just the sensible thing to do, end quote, said his defense lawyer John Olson.
That was the safest way to go. That was the way that would present at least a possibility that Cody would see daylight again, and it would take the death penalty off the table.
Olson also said that if Patton went to trial, some of the details were so horrific that it would have been difficult to avoid a death sentence. At his sentencing phase, Patton addressed Mickey's family.
There's no reason, there's no why, there's no justification for it. Sorry, it's not enough, but I apologize for everything.
He then told the court that his girlfriend was not all to blame, contradicting his first confession where he claimed he was alone.
To the court, I just want to state that my co-defendant, Tony Fratto, is not all to blame.
The judge sentenced him to life without parole. Now, at the time, this wasn't public knowledge, but it was later revealed by Dateline that when Patton took his first plea deal, he told the district attorney that on the afternoon of Mickey's murder, Fratto had confronted Mickey in the school hallway and called her a slut. Apparently, this was a pretty common occurrence. He said that Mickey and Fratto had agreed to duke it out after school and that Mickey had willingly climbed into his car. They headed towards the desert, but Patton didn't go any further because his lawyer showed up and told him to be quiet. In an interview years later with Dateline, Fratto denied that she was ever jealous of Mickey. She also addressed the night of the murder.
There are people who say that you were very jealous and that you manipulated him into committing murder.
I was not jealous of Michaela. Yes, that one thing that I had wrote in my diary, but that was way long early in our relationship. It never was brought up again. Nothing ever recent.
Did you ever say to him, get rid of her?
No, I didn't.
Get rid of her or you lose me?
No.
Didn't say it's her or me?
No.
Didn't give him that choice?
Absolutely not.
When you put yourself back there in your memory, what does that feel like inside?
My heart just sinks, and, you know, to be honest, it's like it takes my breath away. Like, it's hard to breathe and everything. It's not something, you know, you want to sit there and think about.
There are differing stories, so that's why I have to ask these questions.
Right.
And you hit her with a shovel?
Yes.
Why?
Because I was told to. I did not want to do anything to her and everything. He kept telling me over and over again, just do it. It's okay, just do it. And then I just remember him putting her down and him standing over her.
She was struggling, trying to get free.
Right.
Then you backed off.
Yes. I don't know what he was doing up towards the top of her body. I could not see because he was standing in the way.
And that you didn't hold the knife, that you didn't cut her.
Correct.
So it reduced your culpability.
You can say yes. I'm not trying to diminish my actions or anything of what I did, but I won't take responsibility for something I did not do. I was too much in fear. I was scared, terrified. When you're going through a type of abusive relationship, you don't always fight back with your abuser. To be honest, after finding everything out that I know now, I believe I was next.
Why would it kill you?
It was because I was a witness, and I was there with Michaela. I don't know his motive. I don't know. If I knew, I'd be more than willing to, you know, come out and say why, so it would make sense.
But he's just a lunatic or what? I mean,
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
And when he says he doesn't know why, do you believe him?
No. He's got to know why. There's a reason why he did this.
While Fratto still contended that she was unaware of Patton's plans during the interview, she slipped up.
Well, when we finally got out to the designated area and everything.
What do you mean the designated area?
Where everything went down.
That area was designated?
Well, just the area where we ended up.
So what really happened on that fateful evening that ended with three West Wendover parents losing their children? Was Fratto a victim of domestic violence, only participating in the murder out of fear that she was next? Or was she the driving force behind the murder, acting out of pure jealousy? Whatever the case, the motivation behind the brutal murder is still as unclear today as it was on day one.
I want the truth. Will I ever get it? No. They'll never tell me. And there is nothing they can say or do that will make it better. They cannot fix this.
Cody Patton and Tony Fratto both languish in state prisons at different ends of the state. Patton will die behind bars, but Fratto will only be 36 years old when she has a shot of freedom, still young enough to start a family of her own, something that this sadistic duo both denied Mickey Costanzo when they murdered her in an arid desert, hidden away from the bright and flashy lights of the city that they all called home.
Mickey was this lively, loving person who lived life as if there was no tomorrow. And how fortunate is that she lived that way, because one day there wasn't, when she was way too young. And I do my best when I come to a decision of, well, do I take the chance? I think of all the times that she had taken that chance, and I do.
Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd also like to give a big massive thank you to our new Patreons, Hayley Marie and Kyla McGee. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support really does go a long way in helping me cover the costs of hosting, producing, researching, and all that important stuff that goes into running a website and a podcast. If you're interested in ad-free episodes and early release episodes and articles, make sure you check us out on Patreon. I'd also like to thank everybody that has taken the time to leave a review on iTunes or simply listened and shared an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
G.
check out the Murderific True Crime Podcast, hosted by Bernadette from the state of Maine. Topics will include some seriously true scary stories about serial killers, mass murderers, familicides, the missing, and unsolved cases. Go to www.murderific.com to start listening now, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Until then, we will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
Victimology, defined as the study of the victims of crime and the psychological effects on them. My name is Melissa Lee, and I host the podcast, Victimology. As a criminal psychology student, the mind has always fascinated me. What drives those to commit crimes? Are we all capable of it? And most importantly, what about the victim? Join me as I discuss their stories, whether it's through their eyes or the eyes of others for them. Victimology is available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast, Audioboom, and more. We are also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Make sure to follow and subscribe today.